TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, History and the Role of the Military in U.S. Settler Colonialism, Part 2 of 3. Last you heard from historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, she told the story of the Doctrine of Discovery. Imagine a doctrine issued by the Vatican from the mid-15th century on that allowed European monarchies to seize and own lands inhabited by indigenous peoples and begin the slave trade in Africa. Imagine further that in 1823, the Doctrine of Discovery was quietly adopted into U.S. law by the Supreme Court. It remains enshrined in federal law today, limiting Native American rights, treaties, and sovereignty. In her talk at the Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe on October 11, 2017, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz asked why the history of Native Americans is so rarely addressed. Here is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz.
3 years ago, I published a history of the United States titled An Indigenous People's History of the United States, which has found a wide audience and has been adopted in many public and private middle and high schools, as well as colleges and universities and countless community and church reading groups. The most frequent question readers ask after reading this book is, why hasn't it been written before? Why hasn't this book been written before? I'm really flattered by that question because it's the one I ask about texts that deeply move me. At the same time that the information or argument or story is new to me and seems like a revelation, it also seems it was already hidden in the recesses of my brain or heart, a truth actually also embedded in our subconsciousness. But why hasn't this book been written before? We believe we don't suffer academic censorship in the United States, but we do. Rather than being mandated by the government, although Trump seems to be getting into that action, getting professors fired right and left. No, just left, actually. rather than being mandated by the government, professional historians self-censor in response to institutionalized policing of the parameters of what's acceptable and what will be marginalized. A broad consensus reached by the U.S. history profession's elite, along with school textbook standards made by states, namely in the last 20, 30 years, Texas, plus the graduate history students' desire to complete the doctorate as easily as possible and start a successful career, and then to get tenure. The civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, and along with the powerful Native, Chicano, Puerto Rican, anti-war, cultural, countercultural, women's liberation, and gay, lesbian, and trans movements, broke down the existing consensus and created a window of opportunity that institutionalized revisions through the bottom-up creation of Black, Native, Chicano, and gender studies. But that devolved into a kind of multiculturalism supporting the narrative of diversity and contributions to the greatness of the United States. In achieving a new consensus, the new narrative had to ignore Native issues of sovereignty and territorial rights and treaties, rather twisting the inclusion of indigeneity as a racial discrimination question rather than a question of sovereign nations living under settler colonialism. One of my favorite writers, late writers, William Burroughs, narrator, in his 1984 novel, which I highly recommend, The Place of Dead Roads, observes that, quote, people are not bribed to shut up about what they know. They're bribed not to find out. This is particularly true in the writing of U.S. history, my profession. It's not a free speech issue, but one of asking questions that challenge the core of the scripted narrative. Historians are validated to the extent that they remain guardians of the United States origin narrative, with various tweaks to adjust to demands of the excluded to prevent revolutions. Even those flawed advances are currently in retreat. And U.S. gun violence and endless wars are endemic. Various polls show that even the educated general public doesn't know basic facts about the structure of the U.S. government, the Constitution, the rights of states, and the division of powers. Yet there is a widespread acceptance of the greatness and goodness of the United States, along with the extreme mistrust of government, except for the military. A recent tiny Associated Press story provided polling information of U.S. American public regarding their confidence in federal government institutions, reporting only 6% have confidence in Congress, probably zero in this audience. 14% of people said they have confidence in the executive branch, which includes the president and all of the cabinet agencies. 24% say they have confidence in the Supreme Court. However, 84% have confidence in the military. The military is the only unifying government institution, the only one trusted. So we have to understand where that military has come from and what it is. Why is there so little information, analysis, or curiosity in the origins and development of the U.S. military? In history and political science texts, doesn't exist. And teaching at any grade level, graduate school, the military history field, small as it is usually made up of warmongers and former military people and people who certainly never write about what actually happened to form that military. The military isn't even presented as a branch of government, as we know there are only three branches of government. Rather, it's placed under the formally civilian elected president and commander-in-chief of the armed forces. This is meant to scare you because Trump isn't just president. He's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And as he said, I heard him on TV tonight say that he can do anything he wants because he's that. However, from the earliest settlements in the 1600s to the adhesion of the 13 British colonies into an independent nation state and up to the present, the military has been the engine that drives U.S. nationalism, that is, patriotism. Yet generations have little knowledge of interaction with the military. But the annals of military history reveal the architecture of its formation and function and dominance. Air Force officer and military historian John Grenier gives me hope that this hopefully is beginning to change, writes, "For the first 200 years of our military heritage, Americans depended on arts of war that contemporary professional soldiers at that time supposedly abhorred, razing and destroying enemy villages and fields," read Native American, "killing enemy women and children, raiding settlements for captives, intimidating and brutalizing enemy noncombatants, and assassinating enemy leaders. In the frontier wars between 1607 and 1814, Americans forged two elements, unlimited war and irregular war, into their first way of war." So from this period, Grenier argues, emerge problematic characteristics of the U.S. way of war, and thereby the characteristics of U.S. civilization, which few civilian historians or even anti-war activists acknowledge. Here's an example of the matrix that is deconstructed when a thread from the weave of consensus U.S. history is pulled, and why the public discussion of Confederate fetishism provides a teachable moment. In July 2015, the California State Legislature's Black Caucus, I live in California, called on state authorities to change the name of the town of Fort Bragg, California, the site of a former military base 170 miles north of San Francisco, now just a town by that name, because it was named after Confederate General Braxton Bragg. Who knew there was a Confederate general name on an army base or a former army base, a town in California? In the course of his long military career, Bragg, an 1837 West Point graduate, was commander of the Confederate Army in the Civil War and owned a plantation and over 100 enslaved Africans. But that's only half the story of General Bragg's career, as it is of most of the Confederate, as well as Union military commanders. The Black Caucus rightly raised the issue in the wake of the June 17, 2015, Charleston, South Carolina assassination of senior pastor and state senator Clementa C. Pinckney, along with eight worshipers at the oldest historical Black church in North America, Mother Emanuel, which had been founded by Denmark Vesey, a formerly enslaved African, a carpenter by trade who purchased his freedom, and later organized a failed slave revolt for which he and a dozen other insurgents were hung. This event happened on the that date of the hanging of Denmark Vesey. Shocked attention to the church massacre quickly turned to the continued presence of the Confederate flag on the South Carolina State House in Charleston, the assassin being a self-identified white supremacist whose internet photos showed him toting the Confederate flag. A national debate ensued, not only about the proliferation of Confederate flags throughout the South and in white supremacist enclaves and at gun shows all over the country, but also public monuments and place names, particularly army bases named after Confederate officers. There are, in fact, 9 other U.S. military bases in addition to Fort Bragg that are named after Confederate officers, most of them in the South. But Fort Bragg reveals a more complex history. Few in California knew that their state hosted a base, now a town, named after a Confederate general. But the argument began immediately. Those who objected to changing the name, especially the people living in Fort Bragg, there aren't many there, pointed out that General Bragg was a decorated U.S. Army officer in 1857, 3 years before the founding of the Confederacy, when Fort Bragg was built and named. That's certainly different from those bases in the South named after Confederates, all of which occurred in the post-Civil War Jim Crow segregationist era of the early and up to the mid-20th century. In Bragg's case, the naming honor recalled his actions as a captain serving under Major General Zachary Taylor in the United States Army and Marine invasion and occupation of Mexico City in 1847, forcing the Mexican Republic to cede the northern half of its territory. And the purpose of establishing Fort Bragg a decade later, in 1857, to carry out the confinement of indigenous Californians rounded up and forced into the newly established Mendocino Indian Reservation, where a military base was also established and named after Bragg, all before the Civil War. The Black Caucus statement asserted that it was inappropriate to honor an individual who committed treason against the United States in defense of slavery. Nearly everyone who has argued for the change of names of military bases has invoked treason. Yet all of the West Point graduate officers who led the Confederacy, after whom the bases are named, has been honorably recognized for their feats in the invasion and brutal counterinsurgency over a two-year period of Mexico, occupying and terrorizing the civilian population in Mexico City until the government officials with guns at their heads signed a treaty of cession, including Robert E. Lee and several others who served and led the U.S. war against the Seminole Nation in Florida. There were three U.S. wars against the Seminole Nation over the period of 1816 to 1858, all of them counterinsurgent, irregular wars, and all led by West Point graduates, who then, in the later years, became either Union or Confederate soldiers. But it seems it would have been appropriate had these officers not chosen the Confederate side and stayed in the U.S. Army to slaughter Native Americans during and after the Civil War, like nearly every military officer of the Union Army. Sherman, Fremont, Grant, Custer, to name the most famous of the Union officers who later formed the leadership of the so-called Army of the West. In fact, the majority of U.S. Army bases on the continent were initially outposts for wars against indigenous nations, Fort Snelling, Hays, Kearney, Leavenworth, Sill, and Riley, the latter the base of George Armstrong Custer's 7th Cavalry, now the 1st Infantry Division, all named after U.S. Army officers who commanded genocidal wars. For most of the period from the U.S. War of Independence to the 1890s, the sole function of the U.S. military was to kill, round up refugees, relocate and confine Native Americans, and appropriate their land and resources to replace with Anglo-American settlers, and sometimes from other countries like Scandinavians. Particularly slave-owning planters involved in monocash production got most of that land. The Army officers of both the Confederacy and the Union had made their careers in genocidal campaigns against Native nations and against the indigenous and mestizo peoples of Mexico, which included where we are now, annexing half its territory, and including three major declared wars against the Seminole Nation before the Civil War. Both Union and Confederate armies posted regiments west of the Mississippi to invade territories of the Dakota, Cheyenne, Navajo, Apache, and Comanche nations, among others. Wars against the Native peoples did not miss a beat during the Civil War, which saw the military rounding up and deporting the entire Navajo population that Kit Carson could round up to a desert concentration camp where one-third succumbed to starvation, exposure, and disease. And the ethnic cleansing of the Dakota people in their traditional territory in Minnesota to be replaced by Scandinavian settlers. After the Civil War, when the U.S. Army was supposed to prioritize occupation of the defeated Confederate states, forcing a reconstruction in which liberated African Americans could become participating and leading citizens, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, the president, kept shifting armed forces from the South to the West, where a 25-year total war was waged to destroy the Native nations in the Northern Plains, the Intermountain West, and the Southwest. The United States is a thoroughly militarized culture, all the more dangerous because we don't know it. It's subliminal. And it has been since its bloody birth, the blood being mainly that of indigenous peoples in the path of the colonists' relentless expansion during that revolution, their Revolutionary War. We see the signs of militarism all around us and in the media. Just take the NFL thing, you know, in the last few weeks. But as military historian John Grenier notes, The cultural aspect of militarization are not new. They have deep historical roots reaching into the nation's racist settler past and continuing through unrelenting wars of conquest and ethnic cleansing over three centuries. Grenier writes, beyond its sheer military utility, Americans also found a use for the First Wave War in the construction of American identity. The enduring appeal of the romanticized myth of the settlement, in quotes, not calling it conquest, of the frontier, either by actual men like Robert Rogers or Daniel Boone, or fictitious ones like Nathaniel Bumppo of James Fenimore Cooper's creation, Last of the Mohegans. It all points to what D.H. Lawrence called the myth of the essential white American. U.S. nationalism, its national narrative and origin story, is white nationalism. And any historical analysis or current social crisis cannot be comprehended without acknowledging U.S. settler colonialism and colonial violence, centering indigenous America historically and in the present. So I thank you.
That was historian and author Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. You heard the conclusion of a 45-minute speech that she gave at the Lannan Foundation in October 2017. I urge you to go back to TUC Radio's website and listen for free to part one on the doctrine of discovery. That's TUCradio.org. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz had been introduced by a friend and colleague, historian Nick Estes. He's a member of the Loa Brule Sioux Tribe in South Dakota and doctoral candidate at the University of New Mexico. Now Nick Estes joins her on stage for an in-depth conversation.
One of the things you touched on at the beginning is you cited the Genocide Convention. And a lot of people think the act of genocide is the act of killing, and they don't actually read the rest of the convention. And it reminds me of when and why the Indigenous International Movement went to the United Nations. Could you explain a little bit more about the current academic debates around genocide and the memorialization or lack of memorialization or remembering of Indigenous genocide?
In the 1950s, Native American activists like Darcy McNichols and others were bringing it up. And of course, there was the We Charge Genocide manifesto that was led by Paul Robeson and others, and they also had included the indigenous peoples in that manifesto, which you can find online to read. It goes back to the 1920s when Chief Diskaya went on behalf of the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois Confederacy, to the League of Nations and stayed for 4 years, never was allowed in. But he's quite an icon for the people of Geneva, which was where the League of Nations was held. In the 1970s, the United States had not yet ratified the Genocide Convention. They didn't ratify it until 1988, 40 years after every other country in the world had ratified the Genocide Convention. And that was precisely because of the genocidal past of the United States. Even though the treaty was not retroactive, the Genocide Convention is sort of common law, so it can, if it, you know, comes up as a discussion and accusation, actually lead to a world court decision, or which the United States never obeys anyway, that would require reparations or some kind of compensation. So the Genocide Convention was promulgated in the wake of the Holocaust, of course, the Shoah, But it in no way reflects the Holocaust as the bar that has to be reached for genocide, because its title is The Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. So Ralph Limken, who was the main architect of the Genocide Convention and coined that word, it never existed before, looked back at all the pogroms in Europe. The Nazi era was just the most gigantic and horrific of centuries of pogroms. The Genocide Convention then looks at elements like I named, taking children away, which, of course, the boarding schools for almost 100 years in the United States and Canada did, taking the language away, taking children out of the family, taking the child, because they didn't think Native people should be raising the children and putting them in white, usually Christian or Mormon hands, families. These are all listed as acts of genocide. It doesn't require killing anyone. Of course, that is one of the acts, the killing, of course. It does not have to happen during war. There has to be intent. That is written into it. It has to be a policy. Clearly, the relocation, the ethnic cleansing east of the Mississippi was an act. It was an act of Congress. You know, it was a policy. The act in 1953 was called the Termination Act. That was its name, to do away with Indians forever. And it can be done at any minute. There could be another Termination Act at any minute. That's why it's so important, not just to analyze history and what happened, but today, what is happening that might lead to let's say, another Termination Act. Mm.
That was just the beginning of a conversation between Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz and historian Nick Estes. His book, Mini Wiconi, Water is Life, Death, and Liberation, is forthcoming in 2018. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz has been part of the international indigenous movement for more than four decades, working on sovereignty and land rights. She's Professor Emerita of Ethnic Studies at California State University, East Bay. She's the author of many books, including Roots of Resistance, The Great Sioux Nation, and An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Thanks to the Lannan Foundation for permission to use the audio recorded in Santa Fe on October 11, 2017. You can find the podcast or film at their website, lannan.org. Come back for the conclusion of the conversation between Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz and Nick Estes when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.